you then need to somewhat embrace the grind, and that you just need to grind and you just need to push through and just keep going and going. And the grind is only really palatable if you can maintain momentum. So momentum is always constantly important, and that's why these intermediate milestones are so key, particularly when you're taking groups of people with you.
If you want to get stuff done, then you have come to the right place. This is the Get Stuff Done podcast, brought to you in association with RDI Worldwide, a weekly interview series with prominent and diverse people from around the world who will share their own unique insights on what it takes to get stuff done and their personal strategies for doing so. My name is Gordon Dudley, the creator of the Get Stuff Done project and host of this podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. We hope you enjoy this episode and would love to hear your feedback anytime. Let's get stuff done. Hello, everyone. It's time to get stuff done. We're back with another episode of the Get Stuff Done podcast. And today I'm very happy to introduce my guest, David Jones. He is originally from Perth, Australia, but over the last 20 years has been working all around the world, in the UK, in Germany, Taiwan, and is now based in Korea. He started his career in the defense industry, but moved across to RWE Renewable Energy Business around 14 years ago. He has been involved in a number of large projects, project development, operations, JV management, as well as commercial asset management. And he's also had a number of roles across the organization. Currently, he is the country manager for Korea. Talking to him from England, he's currently in Ireland. We both met in Korea. David, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast today.
Pleasure to be here, Gordon. I've watched a number of these episodes and they're great, some really great insights. So I hope amongst many of your esteemed guests that you have in the past, I can maybe make a little contribution.
I'm sure you can. And if for those of you who are not yet following David, he also is quite a regular poster on LinkedIn, providing insights with what he does and the business that he's in. For those of you who are not familiar with RWE, this is one of the largest energy companies in the world. It's a German company. Has in excess of 20,000 employees around the world. And so, David, tell us, first of all, a little bit about what it's like to be head of that business in Korea.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've spent time now in new markets for RWE for about 5 years. And you're kind of caught between two worlds. In one way, you're part of a very big organization that has huge capabilities and experience, lots of people, lots of support. But then on the other hand, you're also running a startup, really, and you get dropped into a country. This is my second country now in our new markets in Asia. And it's really you and a few people in a room. And from there, you need to get everything set up. And the support to do that from, obviously, head office is quite limited because nobody can really help you when you're on the other side of the world. So you really have got a startup mentality of a few people pretty much just trying to get stuff done, which is poignant for this topic here on the podcast. And really trying to set everything up, and then everything from office, org charts, some recruiting people, all the way through to making sure you've got a business, you've got a project pipeline, you're meeting partners, you're establishing yourself with local industry, getting to know government stakeholders and industry stakeholders. So it really is a startup from the very beginning.
And so does that, like you've kind of just alluded to, really have a broad remit to cover the entire business? So you really have the necessity to have to jump into all the different areas of the business. How do you kind of balance that kind of that classic generalist specialist type of argument?
Yeah. So I think the the first thing is that as a generalist, you have to realize that your skills really lie in understanding a little bit of everything and enough to pull it all together and make it work. However, you know, I certainly don't have the expertise in all the areas. And I think being a good generalist is all about recognizing your role as the generalist and, more importantly, the even bigger role of the experts. You know, our organization is a matrix managed organization. There's very big departments with deep expertise in all the different disciplines we need to run a business. And my role, you know, in the country is to kind of guide those different departments to be able to execute their expertise so that we have a well-functioning business. I think that is the real aim and objective, is really to make sure that you can bring together the experts, set the context, set the vision of where you need to go, and allow them to do what they do best. Engineers do engineering best, procurement people do procurement best, HR do HR best, accounting do accounting best, et cetera, et cetera. And it's to give them the frame, the vision of where we need to go, and allow them to execute what they know.
I think that's a good description. I like the way of describing as setting them up for success, right? You're doing the most that you can to make sure that everyone is going to be as successful as possible. And so I mentioned in the intro how all the different countries that you've worked in. What would be some of the kind of, let's say, interesting but maybe surprises that came to you in the different countries, from origins as an Australian going to very different markets and different cultures? What have been some of the challenges around that?
I think the biggest challenges in going to those markets, I would say, is starting with a clean slate and not knowing anybody and not knowing anything about each of those countries. And I think that particularly if I look at my experience in renewables and offshore wind, you know, I moved to Asia after about 10 years of being in that industry. And I very quickly realized that what I need to do is throw out all the knowledge that I know, but rely on the expertise of being in that business, if that makes sense. So the knowledge, the specific knowledge elements of each market, how they work, how they operate, you have to forget all of that and you have to relearn it. But the way in which the industry works, the way in which these projects are developed, the way in which you develop projects, the way you manage people, you manage disciplines, that remains the same. So those are the transferable skills that you kind of bring across. And then your discipline skills, they're gone. They're not really of much use. You can only use them as references to, you know, maybe in these newer markets, you know, offshore wind and renewables is really just taking off. And there are a lot of points where you turn around, you say, actually, this situation here, I remember this 10 years ago in Europe when the industry was just taking off there. That's about the limit to your knowledge.
Right.
Other than that, you need to just rely on those transferable skills, your expertise as a manager and your expertise as somebody who can bring other people together and deliver. I think that's probably the way that I've dealt with those very difficult situations, is to really rely on those skills and relearn and learning new topics and disciplines. And you mentioned the different roles and different areas I've worked in. You know, that lends well to me. That's what I find interesting and exciting, and that's what I want to do. I want to, you know, after 3 to 5 years, say that was great, I really enjoyed it, I'm ready to learn something new and go and do something new. So I think you need to have an interest in that, and you have to find that a comfortable place to be. Some people find it very uncomfortable to be in those situations, but for me, it's I really enjoy it.
Yeah, that starting again element is definitely can elicit very different responses from people, from it being a, you know, like you said, a fresh, exciting new challenge to learn something new, or an overwhelming, you know, insurmountable barrier to what they want to achieve. So yeah, very different kind of reactions. So from what you're saying, it sounds like the industry you're in is actually not very globalized. It sounds like it's quite different country to country. And whereas there are some industries you can literally kind of fly in and everything's working the same, everything's structured the same, it's very much no real country difference. I think from what you're saying, there's actually a big gap there in different countries in how the energy industry works. Is that right?
In the renewable energy industry, absolutely. But I'd even say probably more towards the conventional energy, there are some key differences. I think the biggest, there are a number of differences, but perhaps what I observe as the biggest is the market maturity. So obviously in Europe, the markets are very mature. And with that comes a very established industry, many different players, a lot of economies of scale can be delivered. Everybody's very knowledgeable about the topics. Policy, regulations, laws are very established. They've been fine-tuned over a number of years and they're operating quite well. Whereas we don't have that in these newer markets. We're starting at the very beginning. And probably, the biggest area where I find the difference is really in the maturity of the policy, the legal framework, the regulations. That's the area where we put a lot of focus in. That's the area where we really try and share our experiences as to what's needed in a market to make it work. And I feel that those are the biggest driving differences in particularly renewables as a newer technology in the energy space, really getting that government support. We are very reliant on government cooperation, policy and regulations.
Absolutely. And I guess probably in those scenarios, it helps to be a large, well-known, established global player because you can, as you say, have that depth of expertise and be able to get a seat at the table to discuss policy and how that should be best implemented, which will then lead to obviously even better opportunities down the road. You also mentioned transferable skills. What are some of the transferable skills that you consider to have been the most helpful for you in your career so far?
Yes, good question. I would probably say there's two. One would be the ability to analyze complex situations, very dynamic with many different aspects, bring them together, and then to be able to communicate a situation and an overview of where you are now or where you need to go to, the steps you need to take. And I think the ability to communicate that upwards to very senior people on a board or even your own director before it goes to a board is important. The people around you who you need to work with, particularly in very big companies like ours, a matrix-managed organization, the way you communicate that to the many different departments and stakeholders internally, I think is really important. And then as a leader and a manager, how to communicate that downwards as well to the people who you lead, how to set the vision, how to get their buy-in, how to let them know the direction we need to go and the steps they need to take. So I would say that, that would probably be that kind of analysis of different bits. And I already mentioned the second bit I was going to, which is communication. And I think that the ability to verbally articulate, ability to present yourself and to make sure that people look at you and they're confident about what you've got to say. And then I think probably the biggest one is about how to document and report a situation visually in reports, PowerPoint, things like that, because those messages move on without you and you can't always be there, particularly when you're on the other side of the world.
Right.
And I would say that particularly at very big companies, the ability to clearly communicate in written form is vitally important.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, I think you've highlighted some very important, crucial skills that are needed. And for you yourself, have you been able to refine these skills? I mean, have you had help to refine these skills through your career, or has it been a kind of trial and error along the way?
It's been a learning experience. I don't really think there's been much formal training or education on that front. So it's very much, I think, pushing yourself to raise the bar and to do things over and above what they would normally expect. So maybe when I was, you know, a more junior person, I would maybe over present things and make, you know, I could have simply sat down with, you know, one of my bosses and kind of explained something to them. But actually, you know, articulating that very clearly in a briefing note is something I used to do because I felt that was a more professional and clearer way to get the topic across. I think when it comes to PowerPoint, I find that that's a very heavy medium that's used to visually communicate strategy, communicate next steps, execution plans, because it's got that versatility of not only having the words down there, but being able to make it visually attractive and for it to be understood even better by the way you can visually present information. That has been, a steep learning curve. I would say I'm still on my learning curve on that, on very complex topics, to be able to present those to boards and very senior areas. So that, again, is another thing you learn by experience, by exchanging with your peers, by asking others. And while I'm here in Dublin, I'll be speaking with my opposite, and that's one of my reasons for my visits here is, you know, we will exchange on how we have kind of fared in certain situations where we've been in, you know, briefing similar senior groups, how we're kind of communicating this. I will learn from them, they will learn from me, we will exchange documents, because this is just such an important area to be able to master. So at least in my world at the moment, I think this is something that is a real focus for me in my development.
Yeah, no, I think you, that awareness that it is constant learning and we need to constantly improve, because no presentation or no reporting is ever the same, right? So it always needs to be taken in the context that it has. And I'm wondering, and I don't know whether this might be a little bit sensitive, getting specific about the Korean organization versus others. When you've mentioned about presenting, communicating, and put the message goes beyond you, I've previously experienced some organizations run two tracks of the official communication that is going out and rippling, does through the official channels, and the unofficial channels that go on. And sometimes, in certain circumstances, that unofficial channel is almost more important than the official one, because it's making, you're kind of almost setting foundations for like preparing the audience, etc. I'm wondering how much you do of that, how you feel that is, or what's your stance on that side of communication in the internal side of things?
It's a very good observation, and one that I also share, that there is absolutely this unofficial communication that goes on. You know, Korea is a very connected society. Everybody knows everybody. They're always talking. They're always sharing information. And it's absolutely there. I view it with great caution, because there has been a number of times where, and I think cultural differences, this is where this comes in as well, because language is super important. And I think you always need to dig deeper and find out more about these unofficial communications that come out, because you need to really be certain that something is the case, and you need to understand the probability of some event or something that maybe has happened or will happen. You need to really understand that and then communicate that appropriately. Otherwise, I find that all this unofficial communication comes in, and if it's not managed And if it keeps filtering through and it transfers from unofficial to official, people elsewhere in an organization will just say, everything's changing constantly. We heard this, then we heard this, then we heard this, then we heard this. What really is going on? I feel quite uncomfortable about this. So I think the big part of my job is really to filter that, to understand it and make sure that the right things are communicated, and also to cut through those cultural differences in the use of English, and to really understand what is going on and what we're hearing before making that judgment call as to whether this is a little bit premature to communicate or whether it's the right time. So, I think that's another very important part. And I think sometimes it's a shame that you really need to exercise that sort of scrutiny over messages that are coming through, and you very much are, you become the person who filters that. But it's not through wanting to hide anything. It's just managing this informal communication and making sure the right stuff is getting through, and that the stuff that maybe is a little bit premature and maybe is not so factually correct, and it's more based on someone's feeling of what they think will happen rather than what will happen, that you're kind of dealing with that in an appropriate way and making sure that's not going through as something that will happen and people just draw the wrong perceptions.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, that's kind of next level insights on communication, that the timing is so important, and the consistency is also so important. But ultimately what you're saying is that you are very cognizant of the audience and how they're going to perceive what it is that's being communicated, and the effectiveness of the communication depends a lot on the audience and how they receive it. And so I think that's the bottom line, which clearly you do very astutely in your country market. So coming to getting stuff done, and you mentioned at the start that's again the kind of the crux of your role. On a kind of like, you know, daily working basis, what's some of the David Jones personal techniques for getting stuff done?
Yeah, again, I mentioned that kind of my role is to guide and to kind of give the vision and the outlook. And I think that that is what I really try and do first and foremost, is to kind of set the goal, set the vision, and then let different departments know that, you know, if we need to get there, everybody needs to play a role to do X, to do Y, to do Z. And then I think we have a number of people who are responsible for different projects. We're a project organization. I think I rely a lot on their advice as well, because they will be able to communicate upwards and say, look, these are the conditions we're dealing with. These are the people that are closest to the ground. We will look at that together. And I think we will then draw more advice and experience from other experts, you know, engineering and permitting and, you know, maybe communications experts, people like that, health and safety, HR, and we will make decisions, you know, jointly as to where we think our vision needs to go towards and what we need to execute. So I think setting the vision is something that, you know, is important for me to do. And then how we execute and get to that vision is something that is done with the experts who know best. And I think in our business, it's incredibly complex commercially, legally, on a regulatory and policy front, on an engineering front. You know, there are many different aspects that we need to consider, and bringing people together, the real experts who need to execute, getting their feedback, making sure that we jointly sign up to a plan, and then set a plan that we can manage against. And these plans are normally, you know, 2, 3, 4 years into the future. We need to develop programs. I would say that that's kind of what I really look for. So I guess setting the vision and then to execute towards that vision, really engaging with many experts and getting their input and making sure that we're able to deliver what we need to hit key milestones.
I guess, like you mentioned, you're working on incredibly long projects most of the time, and so that does require a very different type of management and that project management. Coming to a very small time capsule, like daily basis, what are some of just I don't know, do you are there any specific apps that you use to help you manage your time? Is there something that you do to switch off? Tell me a little bit about that on a kind of very daily basis.
Sure. I rely a lot on my PA to manage my time, and we work together with some external consultants who have helped us to get a very organized meeting cascade in place, just because of all the different areas I need to cover. Time is of the essence, and I think that I also need to have a lot of time available for people to just drop in and chat with me as things arise. So, having a schedule where you can clearly see your routine meetings, you can clearly see the spots that are open for people to come and speak, and making sure that is spread out appropriately, I think is really important. So, I'd say that would be one of my biggest tips, is that to make sure that diary management is done well, and you can clearly see the categorization of different activities so that you know where you're spending most of your time, because otherwise I think you can find yourself trapped in different topics that maybe aren't the priority. You need to be able to reflect on your diary and say, hang on a second, I'm spending way too much time next week focusing on these topics. We need to release some time to focus on some other things as well. So I think that that's one of the key things.
Yeah, I don't know which system you're using, but for me, my Google Calendar, just without me asking, has recently started showing me analytics of my diarized time. So a kind of a breakdown of how much time I spent in meetings, how much, and then even like were those meetings multiple participants or single participants, were they online, etc., etc. And it does it all for me, which I think is quite nice. And maybe if I get the chance, I might actually dig into that a bit. One of the takeaways that I got from what you said there was that you also purposely block time for the unscheduled appointments, these drop-ins. So is that's an important element for you?
It is, and it's really based on feedback I've had from the different project directors and project leads that work on our projects and lead them, is that my diary has been so busy that some of them have been waiting for our next catch up to go over topics, so then we race through them, and then other times they're dropping me other messages to just give me updates. And we reflected on it together, and I'm trying to support them the best I can to help them make the decisions they need to make in order to move on. And sometimes they want guidance, they want to talk about stuff, there's other problems that are going on, and things need to be resolved quite quickly. So we decided that we would try and insert time that was kind of really blocked for them, because they are the people leading our projects, and they're the ones that are kind of managing all of the inputs from all the different departments. So I think that that's something that we've adapted to from feedback in the team. I always want to try and find where I can support them best, how I can help them do their jobs the best as possible. And this was one of the areas where I think they said what we would really like actually is the ability to just drop in at different times and give you a call. And if we see in your diary that this is the period of time and I want to that is available, and I can see you're in your office, I can quickly come in and have a chat and we can talk over some stuff. So yeah, that's been something we've adapted to.
It's very interesting because just a couple of months back, the start of the summer, I had a debrief with a team who were discussing about how they could bring in more of this kind of ad hoc type of meetings. And they were really divided between whether that ad hoc meeting time should be scheduled or not scheduled. Because there was a feeling that if the ad hoc meeting time was scheduled, but if it was outside of that time, then it can't happen. But at the same time, that if it wasn't scheduled, then it's maybe ending up in a full calendar and no time. And so it was very interesting to see people's take on that and perception about whether the time used to be blocked, and then of course how people react to that, and whether it's an inside and outside of that time, and how flexible the time is. Many elements to that, and I think ultimately it comes down to the people and the relationships and how they are working as to what works best. I don't think there's one ideal setup or structure that is a fit for all. I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think you know, depending on the people, their roles, the organization, geographically where people are, the hybrid working situation, you need to take all of those factors into account and find the right solution.
Yeah, I think it's an area which maybe is not really kind of talked about enough. I mean, like sticking with the same example of this team brief, you know, they are primarily office based, but certain days work from home, and then they have a kind of a project room where people can co-work. And so they were really getting into if people see people in there, whether they are inclined to go there and work, or whether it's a matter of finding space away from the team. I think that there are some companies that are very much focusing on this in how work is done and how collaboration happens. And it's very interesting because in some cases you need to set clear kind of rules and structures in order that people can follow. And on other occasions, you have to leave it just totally open space, open seating, open meeting schedules, etc. It really is a kind of combination of all those items. And I don't know, maybe there is research out there. Maybe there are companies also helping companies to do this better. I don't know, but it's an interesting topic. David, I want to ask about a time when perhaps you didn't manage to get everything accomplished that you wanted to, and how you went about rectifying that and getting back on.
Yeah, there's a number of times where I guess the prospect of getting stuff done in front of you, whether that be a series of things or one big critical thing, and you can see that that's going to be extremely challenging. You know, that's obviously come up a number of times. I think for me, and I've come through a phase like this just very recently, one of the things to do is to always set that goal as to where you need to go to, and then set a number of smaller milestones in between that as well. And I think that you then need to somewhat embrace the grind, and that you just need to grind, and you just need to push through and just keep going and going. And the grind is only really palatable if you can maintain momentum. So momentum is always constantly important, and that's why these intermediate milestones are so key, particularly when you're taking groups of people with you. I think momentum is what's most important. So sometimes you really just need to you just need to put your head down, you just need to work, and you just need to keep going. And it can be a pretty sometimes difficult situation to see that you're the one that needs to take a whole other group of people with you, but you just have to keep your head down and you just have to keep going and going. And when people see there's momentum, that they follow, provided that we're hitting milestones and we're achieving things, and then you can come out the other end of it. Sometimes it's achievable, sometimes it's not. You've got to do your best. And I think that's what I always focus on is keeping momentum, I think, is the most important thing.
Yeah, I like it. And so, and building on that then, would you have specific people that you have influenced you along the way, whether that's mentors, whether that's just people out there in the public space? What have been some of the biggest influences on you and your working style?
Yeah, so I definitely have. I think probably the biggest influences on my working style is it's a real privilege I've had 14 years at RWE to do so many different jobs. whether that be from an operations kind of focus job, whether it be very commercial and analytical, or even when I did a job as a joint venture general manager, managing different relationships, you know, or as a managing consultant, kind of focusing on optimization of business functions and lean management. I think that, you know, all of those different roles have given me all sorts of different skills that I can always rely on and go back to. So I think that, you know, that's probably been the biggest factor. However, over the years, there have been a few different people that I've had the privilege of working very close with and have learned a lot from. And the sorts of people differ massively. So when I was in the defense industry a long time ago, going back, you know, close to 20 years ago when I started my career after university, you know, I was very lucky to work very closely with a two-star general, and he was extremely intellectual, and I learned a lot about communication, about written communication. Back then, there wasn't really much PowerPoint. It was really just Word documents and typing stuff out, and the ability to write briefing notes, to write, as he would call them, vignettes on situations, on complex topics, and to be able to articulate that and put them together was a really great learning experience. I think there have been others as well where I've seen their leadership and execution style that has been very good. But I would also say that some of the best learning experiences have been working with people that I absolutely do not aspire to be like whatsoever, and seeing very bad leadership, seeing very bad organizational skills, and being very quick to observe the impact that has and how negative it can be. Yes. And I think that a lot of people don't realize, maybe a little bit naive, as to the influence they can have on others, and small actions and small words can be very powerful sometimes. So I think my learning experiences have been both they've all been positive, whether I've observed positive things or negative things. I think observing the negative things sometimes is more valuable than the positive things you observe. So, there's been a full array over.
I think that's a wonderful takeaway. I hadn't really thought about it explicitly, like you mentioned, but I guess we probably do learn more from negative experiences than we do from positive ones. I mean, especially if we're talking about mentors or people that we aspire to, we can see that person, we can then try to emulate them as much as possible, but, you know, probably there's a gap. Whereas when we see those negative influences, we can automatically change something, right? It's easier to stop doing something than it is to start doing something. And so, yeah, I think that's a great perspective. And I was just talking with a former colleague over the weekend. She said that she had an older colleague who was very close to a retirement, had a like basically 30-year career with a company, had worked all over the world. And finally, in this current position, this last role that he had, he ended up with such a toxic manager, he decided to call it quits ahead of retirement and just leave early. You know, this is somebody who loves the organization, has basically devoted their entire career to this company, and finally, in this last position, has come across this unfortunately very toxic manager who... the person just said it's not worth it, and goes out. And I think you're right. The negative ripple effects go much further. Unfortunately, I mean, what's that old saying about how bad news travels fast or something around those lines? I mean, it's in that kind of element. So, look, David, I think we have covered a lot of areas. Thank you for sharing your insights today on the Get Stuff Done podcast. If people would like to reach out to you and maybe get in touch, what would be the best way to do that?
Yeah, I think LinkedIn is a good way. So, people can find me, David Jones, working for RWE in Korea. You should be able to find me, and I'm sure you'll provide a link to my LinkedIn profile. I think that's a great way to professionally communicate and and I do it with many people that I work with and want to look for new opportunities and whatnot as well.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, David. I really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you for your time, Gordon. It's been great to be with you today.
And remember, everybody, let's get stuff done.
Thank you for listening to the Get Stuff Done podcast. If you would like to be a guest in the future, please do reach out. Or if you would like to recommend someone, that would be awesome as well. Make sure you keep listening, as we will be bringing you fresh insights every week, because getting stuff done is something everyone needs.